Sinjir with a cup of caff in his hand.
Maan can be a slippery one, he says. But this isn't like her. Here, drink this.
He thrusts the cup into Sinjir's hand.
You're gonna need it.
I'm going to need something considerably stronger.
That comes later, if we win. Or if it goes the other way.
Sinjir runs long fingers through his dark mass of hair with one hand, while sipping the bitter caff with the other. It's got a hard afterburner kick to it, like drinking a mug of vaporator sludge.
We need to get to Jakku.
That just became a whole lot harder, Leia says. Explain to me again what exactly happened. Mon's opponent in the upcoming election, he knew. Wartol knew about the Empire. And worse, he knew that we knew. Our window to get you to Jakku was very small already, and him making that public just closed it.
Why?
Because, Han interjects, this just became officially political. You go zipping off to that dirt world, it'll look like an act of war on behalf of the New Republic before the Senate had time to do squat about it.
You mean like, oh, say, Kashyyyk?
It's a barb, Sinjir knows, but he means for it to sting. He grows weary of double standards, as weary as he grows of politics, and of nearly everything at this point.
Don't look at me. I say you still go.
Han,
Leia cautions.
I know. But it's what I'd do, and what you do too.
Sinjir groans and takes a long, stiff sniff of the calf underneath his nose.
None of this explains who sent those guards to meet us at the platform, does it? And who told the Orishan senator about all this?
It wasn't you, was it?
Leia asks. She's serious. He retorts the same way she did.
Do you truly believe me so duplicitous, princess?
Before she can answer, he cuts in.
Never mind, don't answer that. No, of course not. It was not me, nor was it Temen.
He declines to remind everyone here that once upon a time, Temen did betray them at the Akivan Palace. And he is young and a bit of a firebrand.
But no, that's impossible. We had an answer. We had a way to Jakku. There was no need to complicate the solution we already had for our problem.
Then it hits him. It wasn't just that Senator Wartol knew something he shouldn't. It was that someone knew everything that went on here.
Which means...
Oh, drat, Sinjir says with a vicious scowl.
The walls have ears.
Huh?
Han asks.
But Leia understands. Her eyes go as big as battle stations, and she thrusts a finger to her lips before offering a gentle nod to Sinjir.
I'll be back, Sinjir says. Time to pay our mutual slicer friend a visit.
His heart races as he exits the apartment, one name waiting on the back of his tongue. Unwilling to be spoken, but present just the same.
Conda.
Chancellor Mon Mothma is bone-weary already, and the day is young. With her one good hand, she smooths the fabric of her white gown.
Are we good?
She asks the woman nearby. That woman, Tracine Kane from Holonet News, stands at the fore of the platform. She looks to a chubby Sullustan nearby, who clucks and Sullustees as he crouches down, connecting cables from the hovering cam to the holoprojector platform. Mon has elected not to speak in front of a crowd. Stars forbid that someone out there boo her or harangue her from the audience, only furthering the assured descent in her approval numbers. Better here, where she can control the environment. And HNN likes the exclusive, especially in an age when they will no longer be the only player. Other networks have begun springing up to compete, which is the earmark of a healthy democracy, Mon believes. Many voices competing, not one voice dominating. Though, she wonders, if Wartol wins the chancellorship, then what? Will it be his voice that dominates? Or is she demonizing her opponent too much? Surely he wants the best for the galaxy, even as they disagree on how best to accomplish that uneasy feat.
"Thank you for coming on such short notice," Mon says.
"My pleasure,"
Tracine answers.
"I was out of the field for a while, covering the war."
"Why did you return to cover politics?"
The journalist hesitates.
"I couldn't look at war any longer.
You and me both."
Mon sighs.
"It feels like we've always been at war. I aim to stop that, but to do so, well, not to put too fine a point on it, but that means the only way out is through. We must end the Empire to bring peace. And to end the Empire, first we must endure politics."
Suddenly she smirks.
"Be cautious, Miss Kane. War may seem like a pleasant dream when you look too long into the abysmal eye of the political machine."
"Noted,"
Kane says, returning her own small smile.
"Bert, are we ready?"
The Celestin cam operator grunts as he stands, then gives a thumbs up. His face flaps lift to show a gummy grin. With that, Mon Mothma steps into the circle. Moments pass. She steadies herself and tries very hard to stop her left hand from shaking. The platform glows blue around the edges. Tracine gives her a gentle nod. Words spring up in front of her. The words of her speech in a slow-moving crawl. It is a speech too hastily written, she knows. Usually, she would take as much time as she could on any speech that goes out this far and this wide. But time is a luxury now, and she has to get ahead of this thing before it becomes a scandal hung around her neck like a heavy weight.
"Yesterday, I became aware of the possibility that the Galactic Empire had retreated to a planet in the Inner Rim, near the unknown regions. A planet of relative insignificance known as Jakku."
Already she curses herself. Should she be saying that about any system in the galaxy? Insignificant? A bloom of embarrassment rises to her cheeks, and it only confirms that she is off her game, and has been off her game since coming out of critical care here on Chandrilla. She pushes past her doubts, because what choice does she have?
"Keep talking, Mon. Our military has already begun efforts to confirm this information. We have launched a ship, the Oculus, under the command of Ensign Arden Del Tura, an expert who similarly helped us during the threat on Akiva. We believe his efforts will confirm what our initial scouting showed, that much of the Imperial fleet is now in space above the planet Jakku. It remains to be seen, however, if this also includes a ground occupation of the planet, or is something else that is not wholly understood."
Uncertainty plagues her. She hates using the military as a lever. And yet at the same time, she now fears that she was too hasty in relieving herself of certain powers. Certainly this would be much easier if the allocation of military resources did not rely on politics. But isn't that exactly how Palpatine felt? The Senate stood in the way of progress. So he manipulated the Senate, overwhelmed it, and inevitably abolished it. No. She is doing the right thing. Politics is meant to be turbulent. It is meant to be slow and steady. Elastic, too, so that the system bends but does not break.
"I would not normally divulge such information publicly, but my hand has been forced. Further, it is safe to assume the Empire is aware of our probes testing the margins of their occupation, which means we must act quickly to seize what advantage we have. As such, I am calling the Senate to an emergency session tonight, where I will resolve that we must mobilize our armed services to war against the Galactic Empire in the skies above Jakku, and perhaps even upon its surface. It is with a heavy heart that I call us to war once more. But I am vigilant that the threat of the Empire must not stand in the way of our safety and our sanity. I know that the Senate will stand with me. And when they do, I am confident that this will be the end of the Empire."
The Chancellor gives a curt nod and steps out of the circle. Tracine gives Bert, the cam operator, the signal. He cuts the feed. The circle goes dark.
You did fine,
Tracine says.
You must have sensed my apprehension.
No.
She's lying, Mon thinks. But so it goes. It is rare that she receives the straight truth from anybody anymore.
It's just... it must be hard, being you. Under siege from every direction.
Yes,
Mon says.
It is hard, but we persevere. Like the Rebel Alliance before us. Like the New Republic now. We persevere.
The man with bronze skin and a scruffy sand-colored beard seems taken aback by the guest at his door.
Oh,
is all he says.
Hello, Condor,
Sinjir says as greeting. He chills his voice, putting some ice into it, just to ensure that it is clear he is not here on a mission of mercy. Also to make it clear that he has no feelings here at all, lest anyone believe him somehow sentimental.
Sinjir.
May I come in?
And if I said no?
Then I would pout so powerfully my moppishness would take corporeal form and kick the door down.
Condor's warm eyes light up as his face softens.
Same old Sinjir. Sure. Come on in.
Inside the man's apartment is the epitome of austerity. Sinjir's fingerprints are long gone. He too prefers Spartan living, but still likes a little splash of color now and again. The bloody blush of a Hayaka flower bouquet, or the rich cerulean of a saltwater octofish tank. Condor has gone back to decor that is black, white, and gray. The only flash the domicile offers is a punctuation of brushed chrome cabinet handles or silver stone tile.
He would have done well as an interior decorator in the halls of the Empire.
I don't feel like the same old, Sinjir says. Maybe just old.
You are not old. Neither of us is.
Fine. Older, then. And definitely not the same.
You seem the same to me.
Well, I feel different, Sinjir snaps.
Oh my, this isn't going as expected.
Not that he should have expected anything else, he supposes.
I need you. Your help, I mean.
By all the bloody stupid stars, untangle your tongue, Rathvelis.
It's not even me that needs your help, so don't get any damn ideas. It's the princess. She needs you.
She could have called me herself.
Yes, but this is sensitive.
Condor leans up against the counter.
You want to sit? Have a drink?
I would like that very much.
No!
Sinjir answers sharply. Too sharply, despite the contrary thought doing loops in his heart.
No, I would not like a drink.
Then maybe you really are a different Sinjir. Not one here to kill me, I hope. Chip stuck in the back of your head?
Condor was one of the ones who helped decipher that little riddle for the New Republic. It's why Sinjir is here now, to see him.
I believe we have a bug in Leia's domicile.
Condor hmms and scuffs a heel against the ground.
This about what's going on? The Empire at Jakku?
Suddenly he stands up straight.
Oh, Sin. Tell me you're not somehow involved in all that.
Two of my people are there. Nora and Jazz. On the ground. Under the Empire's boot.
This may be related to all that. I don't know yet.
They're my people, too.
Condor reaches out to touch Sinjir's arm, but Sinjir pulls away.
Will you help?
He asks Condor.
On one condition.
There are no conditions. You'll not hold me hostage with emotional blackmail. Either you will help or you won't.
Condor sighs.
I just want to know why you left me.
Because we were done.
You could have fooled me.
Obviously. I did fool you.
The slicer chews on that.
Yes. Indeed you did at that.
He's angry now.
Good. Be mad, you fool. Don't be so daft as to fall for a villain such as me.
I'll help you. I assume you mean now.
I mean yesterday, but it's too late for that. So now we'll have to do.
You're mad, Wedge says. Means you're doing busy work, Temmin snaps.
Captain Antilles looks down at the datapad in his hand. It's true. He is doing busy work. But what else is he supposed to do at this point? Behind the two of them, the hangar bustles with activity. Though they have not yet gotten the call to battle, they were told to be ready when it came. That means fueling up. That means loading munitions. Cross-checks abound. Some of these starfighters, X-Wings, Y-Wings, A-Wings, and even that prototype T-70 in the back, will end up on various capital ships before the New Republic fleet flings itself through hyperspace into the theater of war, where the Empire's own malevolent forces gather.
Of course, Wedge thinks, I won't be going along.
None of Phantom Squadron will. The pilots in his nascent squadron are washouts and weirdos to the last. His favorite kind of crew. Reminds him of the days not that long ago in the Rebel Alliance, when you took whatever bush pilot and womp rat hunters you could find, and you stuck them in battle-scarred fighters. You went to war with the pilots you had. Now things are more formalized. More training, more boxes to check, more politics. And he fizzled on that last part. Going out to Kashyyyk with Leia and Akbar was the first outing of Phantom Squadron. And the last. But what was the choice? Abandon Han and Leia? Let Kashyyyk fall to the bombs dropped by those Star Destroyers? Sometimes doing the right thing didn't mean following orders. Following orders would have meant never betraying the Empire in the first place. Never joining the Rebel Alliance. But that's tricky, isn't it? That transition from a ragtag bunch of dissidents and mutineers to a proper government is a hard one. Many of them still have rebel hearts beating in their chests. It's in them to question orders, to fight back when something doesn't seem right, even if it's coming from someone you trust. People trusted Palpatine once. Doesn't matter now. In public, Wedge got a medal. In private, he got reamed out, and Phantom Squadron was shut down. His crewmates have gone on. None of them are pilots now. They're all support crew. Coco runs fueling lines. Jeth Poor is an engine mechanic. Last he heard, Yara gave it all up, and she's out somewhere on a fishing rig. One of the organic-led ones that cleave to the old Chandrillan ways of hauling fish up one at a time on lines of braided Dian thread. And here he is, doing busy work, managing a hangar.
It's necessary work, Snap, he tells the young man. Don't call me that.
Oh, sorry. I thought you liked the nickname.
I did, but now I don't.
Temmin steps in front of him, arms crossed.
You like her.
What?
My mother. You like her.
I...
Wedge feels nervous, suddenly thinking about her. His mouth dry as a new shirt, but the back of his neck goes suddenly slick with sweat.
Nora. Snap. Sorry. Temmin. I was close with your mother. We were friends.
You were more than friends.
With every word, Temmin thrusts an accusing finger. Then he throws up his hands, exasperated.
And fine, I don't care about that. But you care about her. So she's out there, Wedge. She needs our help. She's trapped on a planet, and we can go right now to save her. You have clearances. I know you do.
Wedge barks an uneasy laugh.
I don't have those clearances anymore.
Not after Kashyyyk. And your mother...
He sighs and sets the data pad down.
I do care about her. A lot. And part of why I care about her is that I know she's tough as a handful of hexabolts. That planet won't break her. The Empire won't break her. And we'll get her out.
So you're just abandoning her? I'm not, I swear. But I'm just one guy, without a whole lot to say about any of it. What I can do is what I have to do. This isn't just busy work. It's making sure our ships and our pilots are ready to fly, because they need to hit that fleet like a fist. That's how we get your mother back. We don't just send you or me or the Falcon. We send the whole New Republic. Temin sneers. Glad to hear you've made yourself feel better about not doing a damn thing. I'll see you, Wedge. Snap. Damn it. Temin, wait! But the boy is already hard-charging away in long, angry strides. Sinjir catches Condor through the window. The Slicer asks them all to stay outside while he does his scan of Leia's domicile. From the center of Condor's palm rises a small, hand-machined probe droid, like a little wobbly ball with a nest of needled antennas coming off it at all angles. It hums and thrums and bobbles around the room, a green beam of light sweeping across every corner, every counter, every bit of bric-a-brac. It's not the probe droid that Sinjir is watching, though. It's Condor. Condor is comfortable in his skin, and even more comfortable in his role. There's just something enticing about seeing someone so capable, so confident. The hinge of Sinjir's jaw tightens, like a trap eager to spring.
Look away, you daft clod.
He's suddenly self-conscious about it. Sinjir isn't exactly alone out here, is he? Leia, Han, and their insufferable protocol droid are with him.
Mom!
T2LC is saying as he hands over a digestive biscuit to the princess.
A small bite of bland food to calm your nerves.
I don't need that, LC, but thank you.
Leia waves it away, then to Han.
I can't believe I was so foolish. A listening device? In our home?
Relax. Solo shrugs it off. We don't even know if that's what happened yet. Maybe this is some kind of fluke.
No,
Sinjir says.
This is no fluke. Someone is listening in. It's the only explanation.
Except for Temin having betrayed us all.
I confirmed with Mon, Leia says. Those guards that turned you away from the Falcon, she didn't send them.
Han nods.
That means Wartol did it.
Does he have that kind of power? Sinjir asks. He's just a senator.
A senator running for the chancellorship.
And, Leia adds with a sigh,
currently pulling ahead with a rather robust lead.
Solo throws up his hands.
Politics is mean business. I'd rather fall into a nest of starving Gundarks than get caught up in those gears. Wartol has power in places we can't see. He's close with the Senate Guard, too.
As a candidate, he has access to them. They protect him. This Orishin. Sinjir would very much like to pay him a visit. He would then like a heavy stick to pay a visit to the man's knees.
Be assured, Sinjir says. Condor will find something.
Minutes later, the Slicer emerges.
I didn't find anything.
Well, thanks for that,
Sinjir thinks.
How? How is that possible?
How? There's nothing to find. No listening devices, no cams. Unless Wartol has someone building devices who's more sophisticated than I am.
The Slicer smirks.
And no one is more sophisticated than I am.
That damn smirk. That big-eyed confidence. Those cherub cheeks puffing out underneath his scratchy beard. You adorable, incorrigible demon. Still, can't let Condor have his day.
You failed us. Someone out there is more sophisticated, it seems, because...
Because it's easier to insult your abilities than admit I'm wrong.
Because I'm right. Plain and simple.
I'm sorry, Sin, but I mean it. I didn't find a damn...
The small probe droid held fast in Condor's hand begins to beep in fast staccato. It shudders in his grip. The slicer utters a grunt of surprise as the droid suddenly leaps out of his hand and takes flight. It doesn't go far, though. It whirls around in a circle and stops in front of the protocol droid's gleaming face.
Oh, my!
T2LC says, alarmed. The probe scans the protocol droid's face, and then it lights up like a detonator about to pop. Flashing lights, klaxons, a vibrating buzz. Condor swipes it out of the air and powers it down, clipping it to his belt as it falls silent. All eyes turn toward the protocol droid.
It's not me, Mum!
The droid objects. Han Solo scowls and reaches for the protocol droid.
Elsie, you ought to hold still. This is gonna sting a little.
Mon Mothma comes into her office, tired, feeling gutted. She has just given her speech to the Senate, her last plea. An easy one that asked for their vote to send the brunt of the New Republic's military to Jakku in order to end the Empire's oppression once and for all. She was uncharacteristically jingoistic, but they need this vote. The Chancellor told the hundreds of senators present in the last Chandrillan session that this will be the defining battle of the war. It is likely to be the final battle of the war. She presented to them all the facts as they had them. Data from probe droids and the Oculus that demonstrated plainly that the bulk of Imperial forces are present and accounted for. The numbers, she reminded them, are on their side. They are no ragtag junkyard fleet going up against a monolithic battle station. Not this time. Their own military forces have more than tripled since the destruction of the second Death Star at the Sanctuary Moon. Meanwhile, the Empire's own fleet has been whittled away. A tree to a branch to a bundle of splinters. And then dust that becomes nothing as the wind takes it away. Or so she hopes.
We can win this, she told the Senate.
She meant it. Then her time on stage was over. Applause came up behind her like a rising wave, urging her forward out of the Senate House and pushing her all the way back to her office. Now she feels stripped down, hollowed out, weary, bleary, and done.
I can't be done yet. Soon, but not yet.
Yes, the day has nearly eaten her alive, but it did not. She has persevered. And soon, Mon Mothma shall be triumphant. At every turn, some new snarl presented itself, and she or Oxy or Akbar had to spend additional time unraveling each knot. Never mind the overwhelming number of administrative duties that threatened to draw her down like a slurry of sucking silt sand. Everything is prepared. The moment the Senate gives their easy approval, the mechanism of war will wind up quickly, triggering events as needed. It calls to mind a match of rivers and roads, the old Chandrillan game of toppling over tiles. One falls into another, and into the next thereafter, and they speed along. If you place them correctly, they all fall down, and they fall more swiftly than those of your opponent. If you fail, they fall too slowly, or never fall at all. Once the vote is in, the ships launch. The ground forces mobilize. Everything begins. And hopefully, her tiles fall faster than the Empire's, and this is truly the end of that oppressive regime's rivers and roads. She collapses into her chair. Oxy sweeps over, a bulbous, long-necked bottle of very good brandy held in the same hand, with which she precariously grasps two glasses by their rims.
I think this calls for a nip.
What's the old saying? You can never count the stars, for some may already be dark.
The vote isn't in yet, Oxy. But it will be momentarily.
She sets the glasses down and begins to pour. Rich amber liquid sloshes around the bell of each.
And we'll win. But what does it matter? After the day we've had, I think we deserve a bit of the good stuff. Oh, and your numbers are already improving nicely. They were up before you even stepped on stage.
Mon sighs and takes the glass in her good hand.
People do like war.
No, shh, stop that. People like to know that they are safe. And in this case, if that safety is earned by grinding the last Imperial stormtrooper into the dirt, then count me among them.
Their brandy glasses tink as they tap together. Mon takes a sip. The liquor is warm in her mouth, and as she swallows, it spreads its heat to her throat and her belly. As it goes down, it's like a zipper opening her up. All this tightly packed material inside her heart suddenly unspooling. She feels like she is almost ready to breathe a sigh of relief and sleep a very long sleep.
Don't get too comfortable, she cautions herself. You won't be able to rest long on your laurels. Akbar will lead this battle, but it is you who oversees the war, Chancellor.
As if on cue, her office door chimes. Akbar enters. She is poised to ask him if it is time to launch, time to complete the dread task they set out to complete many years before with the first stirred embers of the Rebel Alliance.
But she sees now the stark look on his face.
Mon Cala are hard to read for most humans,
but she knows Akbar well,
and she spies the reluctance in his stiff-backed posture, in his curling chin tendrils, in his half-lidded eyes.
Tell me, she says.
The vote did not pass. We are grounded, Chancellor. The fleet will not go to Jakku, and there the Empire shall remain.
Part 2, Chapter 12.
Cold, rank water hits Nora in the face. It pours over the top of her head. A sour bile spit smell filling her nose. She coughs and sputters, standing up inside her cage. Two stormtroopers stand on the grated metal ceiling of the prison in which she sits. Above them, the Imperial fleet hangs, veiled behind bands of gauzy clouds. One of the troopers holds a bucket. The other has his blaster rifle pointed down. From her vantage point below them, with the sun above, the Imperials look like little more than shadows, scavenger birds, ready to pick her bones as soon as her flesh gives up.
Wake up,
the one with the bucket says. He lets it hang loose, and it knocks against the side of his armor. Armor that's no longer the pristine white of most troopers. This armor has been marked and gouged, painted and carved into. The one with the blaster rifle has blood-red dye spattering the face of his helmet, shaped into the crude icon of a skull. Taking what was always metaphorical about the stormtroopers and literalizing it, we are the agents of death, it says. We are killers.
I could just shoot her,
the rifle-holding trooper says. He gestures down through the bars of the wrought metal cage, the tip of his rifle poking through.
She's just another mouth to feed. I could close that mouth permanently.
Do it, she whispers. He does. No! The blaster goes off, and everything around her lights up red. The bolt digs a furrow out of the hard sand pack beneath her feet. She dances away from it, panic throttling her.
She's awake now,
the bucket holder says. The two troopers laugh and keep walking, boots clanging. Nora kneels down and weeps. Hours later, she's up and working a Kesium gas rig. It's a big cylinder bore screwed into the sand, and it needs people all around it to turn valves and tug levers to balance the rush of gas coming up from beneath the mantle. Let too much up at one time, and the whole thing pops its top, maybe blowing them all to vapor. Let too little up, and the shaft line seals shut as the sand collapses back into the channel. She's here, chained along the edge with half a dozen other prisoners, all shackled around the circumference of the well. If any one of them fails, they either get punished or get dead. Worse, she still smells like bile and spit. That, courtesy of the bucket dumped over her. It wasn't water. Oh no. Nobody would waste water on this planet just to wake up a prisoner. It was backwash from a hapabore trough. Rancid water sloshed in and out of their leathery maws. Nora, at this moment, has never felt so alone. When the troopers brought them here, they scanned and ran their faces, said that there was a bounty out for Jazz. Before Nora knew what was happening, they were throwing her friend aboard a sand-scoured shuttle. And just like that, Jazz was gone. That was a week ago, or longer. Nora can't even tell anymore. After they took Jazz, some puck-cheeked officer asked Nora point-blank if she wanted to die or if she wanted to work. The answer was easy. If Nora gets dead, then that means Sloane escapes. Death was not an option. Not until revenge had its day. "I'll work," she told him. So they brought her here. Where here is, though, she barely knows. Kilometers from some place called Crater Town, apparently. And so she works. Every day she works this same black valve. The metal on the wheel so hot, it first blistered her fingers. By now, though, those blisters have turned to calluses, and the skin around them is dry and splitting. It doesn't even bleed. I don't think I have blood anymore. Just dry Jakku dust whispering through her veins. To her right, a hollow-eyed alien hunches over a set of levers. The bone-white creature doesn't talk much. Occasionally it moans into the backs of its hands. It weeps tears that glitter like silica. To Nora's left is a dirt-cheeked man. His face round and thick, even though the rest of his body looks like a skeleton draped in the rags of his own skin. He sometimes grins over at her, the broken-toothed smile of a bona fide madman, and he sings little songs. Gom is his name.
Gom, Gom, the big do-bum, the wombo-bum, speaking on the intercom, there's a woozy holocron.
His words, not hers. One of his bizarre songs. He reminds her in a way of Mr. Bones. If Mr. Bones were a lunatic prisoner stuck on a dead dirt world.
Fancy a mancy,
he says to her.
Fancy a mancy,
she answers back, not having any idea what it means. It matters little.
Nora needs to get out of here.
An obvious sentiment, but true just the same. She's been thinking on escape plans, and none of them are sensible. The chains that bind them are literally just that. Chains threaded through metal manacles. Breaking them doesn't seem to be an option. Not by herself, at least. She thought about sabotaging the rig and letting it explode. But what good would that do her? It's a fantasy to think that somehow it would bulge and detonate in just the right way, shearing her chain and letting her free. Far likelier to turn her into a scattering of charred bone across the sand. Plus, this Kesium rig is not the only one. Front to back, another dozen rigs topping another dozen wells sit all around. If this one goes, they all might. Which means she might not kill just herself. So that's not an option. What then? She has no answer. She keeps working. She tries to cry, but no tears come. Nora has no more tears, just as she has no more blood. It seems that on this planet, she'll just dry up and flake away when the night winds come. At the end of the day, they throw her back in the cage. A portion of food lands in with her, a rubbery plastic packet of protein mush. Sometimes it's a powder, and they give her a little water with it, and the powder sizzles and turns into something. A ballooning piece of bread. A cup of gruel. A biscuit so hard it's like biting into a fresh-baked brick. Today, though, it's just this packet of goop. She tears the top off with her teeth and greedily slurps it down. It tastes like the Hapabore spit smells. But it will sustain her. Ah, nothing better than eating one's own sick. That voice. She knows it. She wheels around on the one who spoke. And there stands Sinjir outside her cage. A cocky tilt to his hips and a smug, self-satisfied sneer on his face. He nips from a flask. Nora, dear.
How?
She asks.
Who can say? I am cold and conjured. I'm here to rescue you.
My, my, we do find ourselves in cages, don't we? And I don't mean that as a thematic conceit, either. I mean, well, look around you.
Metal cage. Imprisoned once again. Naughty business, this empire. Well, get me out of here, she says.
A hand falls on her shoulder. She startles, crying out, raising a fist to whoever would grab her.
Whoa,
Temin says, holding up both hands.
Hey, relax. It's okay. It's me. It's your son. We're getting you out of here. Me and Wedge. Just sit tight.
Her son? He's here? He came back for her. And there behind him is Wedge Antilles. And he's got that boyish smile and those dark, warm eyes. For a moment, the pulse in her neck quickens. And yet, how are they here in the cage with her? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Suddenly, she's doubling over, her middle clenching up as waves of heat and cold take turns crashing into her. Sweat slicks her brow even as her lips go dry. She tries to say her son's name, but all she can manage is a sad mewling, like a rodent caught in the teeth of a trap. She looks up to him, but he's gone. So too is Sinjir. They were never here at all, were they? No. Just illusions pressed upon her by the heat. Suddenly she understands Gom. The sun and dust have blasted his sanity away, like a coat of paint scoured free. And she wonders if sanity is really just that. Something to be worn off. A veneer that with enough pressure and effort can be stripped away. Civilization, too, can fail the same way, can't it? Scraped down to nothing, leaving only the raw metal of anarchy and oppression behind. And madness. That is the Empire. That is what it has done to her and to the galaxy. A corrosive force eating away at everyone and everything. A new illusion seizes her. This hallucination reaches her ears before her eyes, and she hears the mechanized voice of her son's droid, Mr. Bones. Trails of sand slither along on a sudden wind, like snakes, and they carry those familiar words of his.
Roger, Roger!
Distorted and broken by static. And sure enough, the hallucination completes itself as it reaches her eyes, too. Nora lifts her head, no small effort, and glances over her shoulder to see Bones trotting along through the camp, pushed along by a stormtrooper whose mask shows the carvings of endless jagged spirals. The trooper says to a nearby officer,
"Found this out by the step. It was poking around another escape pod."
"Look at this old thing,"
the officer says, sitting under a small tent pitched in the dirt. It's the same pock-cheeked prig who brought her here. Effny, she thinks his name is.
How kind of him to participate in my hallucination,
she thinks, and laughs out loud at the absurdity of it. He lifts the saw-toothed beak of the old droid with one hand, while using the other to dab his brow with a wet sponge.
This old clanker has seen some modifications since the Clone Wars. Probably belongs to some nomad or spacer.
I fitted it with a restraining bolt. What do you want me to do with it?
Effni pulverizes the sponge in his fist, and a stream of water spatters his outstretched tongue. Nora knows the droid is just a vision, but that water isn't. It's real. So real she can almost taste it. Water. The officer, done drinking, wipes his mouth with the back of his hand and answers.
I don't care one way or the other. Destroy it. Wait. No. Send it on the next transport ship heading back to the Ravager. The old man is up there, and I'm sure Borum would find it a fascinating piece of antiquity. Maybe he'll pull for us to get some more portions down here.
Yes, sir.
To the droid, the trooper says,
Move along, B1.
Roger, roger.
Nora pushes her forehead against the scabby metal of her prison. She watches Bones march away, his servos whining, his joints crunching as this world's grit grinds between them. This hallucination is quite the persistent one. Unless, poking around another escape pod. What if? Could it be? What if Temin sent Bones before the moth hit hyperspace? What if he ejected the droid? Or himself? The heat once more is pushed away from her, this time not from feverish chills, but from the cold realization that this is no phantasm. That mirage is no mirage. It's Mr. Bones. It's really him.
I fitted it with a restraining bolt.
Send it up on the next transport ship.
No! She needs that droid! Bones can save her! Nora has no plan. Not that there's any time for one. Suddenly she calls out, That's my droid! The trooper halts. So does the officer.
Bones keeps walking, until the trooper grabs him with a rough glove and yanks him back.
The officer and the trooper share a look. And with the hook of a finger, Effni gestures them forward. The officer stands in front of her.
You, he says. What did you say?
I said, that's my droid. Her voice is raw, as if her vocal cords have been dragged behind a speeder over volcanic stone. She bares her teeth.
I want him back, now.
The trooper stands there, looking from her to the droid. The officer just laughs. Bones, for his part, seems to pay no attention to any of this. In the center of his narrow ribcage-like chest sits a black restraining bolt.
You're telling me you own this droid? The officer asks.
I am. You let him go. And me too. Or you're in deep spit.
The officer grabs the stormtrooper's blaster rifle.
This droid?
He points the blaster and fires.
The droid's arm spins away, detached from the body. The shoulder socket sparks as the arm hits the ground.
No!
She cries out.
Wait! Please!
Are you sure you mean this droid? Effni says through a venomous scowl and slams the droid up against the cage.
She reaches for Bones through the metal, but suddenly the air lights up with blaster fire. She can't see the officer, not at first, because Bones' frame blocks her view. But as laser fire tears bits of the droid off, piece by piece, so does her view of that officer become more complete. His face is a mask of rage. And again she has that image of sanity being scrubbed away, revealing something altogether more monstrous underneath. Bones stands there and takes it. Parts of him shot off by the blaster rifle. Limbs and bits banging against the cage before hitting the ground. Until he has been broken apart into a pile of constituent pieces. Until Effni is standing there, sweating, panting, leering. Until she too is broken, collapsing backward.
She sobs, though again, no tears come out. She turns and throws up, but it's just dry heaving. Nora curls up on her side and gazes into the eyes of her son's droid. Eyes that flicker before finally going dead and dark.
Effni offers a dismissive sniff. He tosses the blaster rifle back to the trooper, who barely manages to catch it.
Sorry, scum. It seems this droid is malfunctioning.
To the trooper, he says,
I suppose Borum won't get to see this curious antiquity after all.
Should I clean it up?
The trooper asks.
No. Let her look upon the wreckage of this mutant machine.
He gasps suddenly.
Gods, it's hot. I need water. Let's go.
They walk away. Bones remains in pieces.
Nora curls up into herself.
Chapter 13. A patch of blood decorates the stone wall of her cell. It's dry now. Dry for days, maybe.
And once Mercurial catches sight of her, it's easy enough to see what happened. She fought back, and Nima's blank-eyed slave boys roughed her up. The side of the Zabrak's head is scuffed raw and scabbed over. Her hair, normally thrust up like the feathers of a proud bird, flops over that side of her head, matted there with blood. The blood's dried in purple streaks down the deep sea blue of her skin, forming new tattoos all the way to her jawline, framing that famously vicious grimace of hers.
Jazimori, you are mine.
He doesn't bother greeting her. No words. Just a smile. Big and beaming. It's enough to show her.
I'm the one who caught you, little fish.
She thought she outsmarted him back on Terrace. And, he admits, she did. But it was only a temporary embarrassment. A failed move in a bigger game.
A game he just won.
He nods to Nima's freaks. They murmur and mumble as three of them storm into her cell, looping rope.
Rope?
Of all the primitive things, around her wrists and dragging her out. Mercurial is glad to have Nima's hospitality, and he's just as glad the hut isn't here. He doesn't know Nima, but he knows huts. They're given over equally to brutality and formality, and he has no time for either of those things.
Plus, they're disgusting.
Giant slime-lubed parasites drinking from the blood flow of the universe. Mercurial has little issue with parasites, given that he is one himself.
But the slime?
Ugh, that he can do without. Haughtily, Mercurial leads the way. The hut slaves drag Jazz behind them, and she struggles to keep up. The bounty hunter is buoyant with triumph. He feels a spring in his step.
This is going to be a good day.
Her capture was easy. He thought he'd have a long hunt ahead of him, so he hired a whole crew to help. And then the girl just drops into his lap? An easy win. One that still required him to be in the right place at the right time, of course. He deserves it. He deserves the payment, too. But does his crew? Maybe he won't pay the crew after all. A few credits to get them on their way. Or maybe no credits at all. After all, what work did they do? It darkens his feeling of victory a little, having to share the cut with those old knobs. It would be much better to keep it all, especially since they did literally nothing except come along for the ride.
He ponders this as they walk down the smooth stone passageways of Nima's cavernous temple. In this, she's quite unlike the other huts he's known. They favor opulence and amusement. Jabba's palace on Tatooine was positively baroque. This, though, is about as spare as they come. It's just
boreholes and tunnels sculpted out of the fire-red stone. The tunnels are smooth in some places, scalloped in others. And he doesn't know if they're natural to the landscape, or if the hut chewed or somehow secreted her way through the rock. Stranger still, there's almost nothing powered here. Minimal electricity. No droids that he's seen. Even Amari is bound with rope. Not chain, not shackles, not cuffs. Common rope. They pass by more cells. In one of them, the hut slaves hold a man down, carving off hanks of the old spacer's hair. The man screams as they shear him down to the skin. The freak stuffs something in his mouth, a dirty rag. One of them sticks a needle in the corner of his eye. His screams dissolve into mushy murmurs behind the gag. A puff of coppery dust, and they begin to paint the man's face red.
They're making more of themselves, Swift thinks.
Nima enslaves her acolytes, and in turn they make more acolytes. Like a spreading disease. He keeps moving, putting forth a brisker pace. The sooner he can be done with this, the better. His ship, a Corellian shuttle, awaits. Still, something nags at him. His good feeling is eroding fast. He also doesn't like that Amari hasn't said a word. She's keeping her mouth shut. And while that should please him, it doesn't, because it means she's not giving him any satisfaction at all. And Mercurial demands satisfaction. The bounty hunter tells himself he's not going to say a word either. And next thing he knows, he just can't help himself. He keeps walking, facing forward, as the words tumble out of him.
I don't think you appreciate the trouble you're in, Amari. And I don't think you get that I'm the one standing between you and Boss Gyuti, taking your head as a trophy. So now's the time.
He grins, flippant. He makes a lasso gesture with his finger above his head.
You want to beg? Beg. Plead if you can. Cut me a deal. Come on, Amari. You're a bounty hunter. You know the art of the swindle? Unless you just want me and my crew to bring you in.
And yet, nothing. So disappointing. He stops suddenly and rounds on her.
The bounty is for you alive or dead, Amari. And I'm happy to take your head.
Wait. What are you doing? Her hands, bound in front of her, hang in front of her mouth. Her cheeks bulge until they don't. A slick string of saliva connects her lower lip to her knuckles. Her eyes flash with mischief. Mercurial only realizes what's happening when it's far too late. Jazz tilts her head, and the hair upon her scalp flips from one side to the other. When it does, it reveals the topography of her skull. And gone from that side of her head are her spikes. Three of them, broken off. The nubs puckered with dry blood.
Where that?
Oh no. The spikes are in her hand. Swift staggers backward, heels scuffing stone as he reaches for the batons that hang at his side. Amari's hand forms a fist around the spikes as she moves forward, fast, too fast. And already those bony thorns are thrust up through the gaps in that fist, sandwiched between squeezed fingers. His fingers find one of his batons. Slow. Too slow. The hut slaves don't even know what's happening. Her fist flashes in front of his face. Three spikes slash, drawing sharp lines from his chin all the way up to his brow. Pain throbs. All he sees is red. He whips out the baton, but his fingers fumble, and it drops. Swift trips over his own foot. His shoulder slams hard into the wall as he falls. Above him, he sees the blurry image of Jazz Amari vaulting over him. With a pivot twist of her wrist, she uses the rope to yank two of the hut slaves with her. And both of those freaks collapse into Swift, just as he tries once more to stand. Her knee connects with one of their heads,
and that head slams into the bridge of Mercurial's nose with a dull pop. Behind his eyes, he sees hyperspace streaks. He roars.